Well, welcome back, everybody, to Say Who, Say Pod, a podcast about University of Washington football. I'm Christian Capel. He's Danny O'Neill. The Huskies came back down to earth a little bit on Friday night, didn't they? A 40-32 loss to UCLA at the Rose Bowl. They will not go undefeated in Kalen DeBoer's first season. What else did we learn on Friday night?
We learned that this defense has a lot of pretty deep-rooted issues, and we're going to see like all of the little sort of fears. Like, I'd talked about the run defense. You'd talked about the cornerback depth. It turns out, all of the above. Plus, they can't get a pass rush or contain. I don't want to heap too much on the difficulty in containing DTR. He's a really good quarterback, and he played a really good game. And I've seen him play good games before. But that was a pretty poor defensive showing by the university. That was a Nick Holt defensive showing by the University of Washington.
I'm trying to think of the last time the defensive backs have been that exposed in a game. And was there a
Alamo Bowl?
Yeah.
Baylor.
I mean, geez, was it the last game of the...
No, they've given up points since then. We don't have to go that far back, but it was that sort of game where you just knew they weren't going to stop them. Like, it's strange when you get into a game like that and you're like, yeah, they're just not going to stop them. And if they stop them, it's going to be due to good luck. I don't see any reason to think that this defense is suddenly going to dig in its heels.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, so much optimism from the 4-0 start and warranted, you know, because look at like the offense is so much better. And I don't think you feel any differently about that group after Friday. They had more issues than they had. There were a couple interceptions and a couple sacks, but like, in the second half, you saw what they're capable of, and they hung in there and they made it a game, and they were able to do that because this is a legit passing offense now. But you know, even they sacked Tanner McKee 8 times. They dominate Michigan State. Kent State is a pretty easy tune-up. Portland State is a blowout. But every one of those games just kind of like gave you that sort of feeling in the back of your mind, like, well, like the numbers won't bear it out, but this defense is going to have a lot to answer for once they face a quarterback who actually commits to like attacking them through the air regularly. And look, they're hurt, they're banged up. It sounds like Mishael Powell has no chance of playing this week. Kalen DeBoer gave the like, well, maybe there's a chance Asa Turner could play, but yeah, I'll believe that when I see it. So, you know,
but those are normal injuries, right? Like, this isn't a convergence where, I mean, I guess you had both Perryman and Powell hurt, but it to me feels like they've had normal injuries. They just didn't have any depth there. They didn't have Pac-12 depth in their secondary.
Yeah, and you talk about Asa Turner and Mish Powell. I mean, they were going to start the season best case scenario with guys who have a lot to prove.
Yes,
right, like, you know, Mish Powell gave up a touchdown in one-on-one coverage against Kent State. And, you know, there's been, you know, obvious questions about Asa Turner. I do think he had kind of turned the corner and was heading toward having a really good year or, you know, potentially having a breakout year at safety. But, you know, even those guys are kind of still unproven. And, you know, the hope would be that like their best football is ahead of them. And now you don't even have them. And you've got a redshirt freshman and a true freshman out there at corner, and you're trying to figure it out. And for the first time since probably pre Chris Peterson, they just don't have the guys back there.
And we saw that because they had to play from behind, and the hallmark of each game, and this is due to their offense, is that they've staked out big leads. And then when they've given up yardage in those games, which they have, every single one of them, they've given up yardage, you've kind of had this question in the back of your mind, like, okay, I don't want to overreact to this because the defense is playing the clock as much as the opponent, right? Like, in every one of their games other than Portland State, like, you saw the opponent mount drives later in games. And in all of those situations, you're like, it didn't really matter because they didn't get into that situation. They never got to the point where, like, okay, they're really in danger of losing this lead. It was like, okay, they're still in control of it. It'd be better if they forced some punts, but you're playing the clock. And this was the opposite, where they got down and Penix threw a couple of interceptions where it looked like he just didn't anticipate the defender, both picks looked like they were from defenders who he didn't anticipate covering, came off their primary coverage responsibility and saw where he was going with the ball. So I think he stared both receivers down. That would be my armchair assessment of how they happened, is that both DBs looked at it and said, oh, he's throwing to this guy, and then dropped off and put themselves in a place where Penix wasn't anticipating it. And that defense never got stops. I mean, what, the first punt was like 5 minutes to go in the game?
Yeah, it was like mid fourth quarter.
Bobo just running circles around him, and they couldn't tackle Charbonnet, which you kind of hinted at. Like, okay, Charbonnet is a really good running back, and we don't know much about this run defense. And turned out that Bobo was a problem.
Yeah, that guy's good.
He is good.
Like, UCLA, I mean, you know, they've taken some slings and arrows from us, certainly on their kind of recruiting efforts under Chip Kelly, but like, they've kind of done a pretty underrated job in the transfer portal. Like, Zach Charbonnet came from Michigan.
Yep.
Jake Bobo, they got from Duke, and that was kind of like, you know, Jordan Addison to USC, and really just USC generally, the way they turned that roster over, got all the attention transfer wise. You know, Jacob Cowing at Arizona, and that's turned out to be warranted. He's really good too. But yeah, like Jake Bobo, like UCLA added this really good, you know, veteran receiver who you saw. I mean, he's big, he's physical, he's hard to tackle. And then, hello again, Laiatu Latu. He gets to Michael Penix early for a sack. He forced one or two holding calls. He was a problem, you know, and he was exactly what like Washington thought this guy was going to be when they recruited him. So, you mentioned the Penix interceptions. That first one was such a great example of the way that holding penalties can kill a drive.
Oh yeah,
because they had a third and one. Cam Davis converts it easy up the middle. You're moving the chains, probably still feeling pretty good about your chances of scoring, but no, it's a holding penalty, and it was enforced 11 yards for some reason. They went from third and one to third and 12. I don't know if that was a spot foul deal or what.
Yeah, do they penalize it from the spot of the foul?
I think it's supposed to be from the previous spot.
So I think so too. Oh, you're saying that the Pac-12 officiating can't do basic math?
I've got more on that in a bit, but.
Do we have more problems with the officiating?
Yes.
I loved last week's with Washington State and Oregon.
Well,
they ran two plays and then said, oh yeah, you know those two plays that we ran? Forget about those. We're going back. We're gonna fire up the DeLorean and rewind time two plays.
Do over.
Seriously, because we thought it was, we told him it was fourth down, but it was really third down, so we're gonna go back to third down.
There was so nothing in the Washington UCLA game that will warrant a public apology. So it didn't rise quite to that level. But I mean, they get called for holding. Now it's third and 12. You're frustrated. Yeah. Ugh, you just got the first down, and now geez, now it's third and long. And I think there was a little pressure on that play. And yeah, I mean, you started to see a little bit like, okay, when Michael Penix Jr. has some consistent pressure on him, and you force some, like, you know, long passing situations, they've still hit a bunch of those, right? I mean, they go for it on fourth and six on the first drive, and he gets Odunze down the sideline for a touchdown. But you did, like, start to see a little bit, okay, here's how you can stymie this offense and stymie Michael Penix Jr. Did think he bounced back in the second half really nicely. I mean, they did hang in there and fight their way back. And, you know, in the past, if a Washington team got within one score with 4 minutes left and some timeouts, like, you felt pretty good about kicking the ball deep, you know, and getting it back, because you had a defense that could stand up and maybe get you a stop. I did kind of wonder, like, there's too much time. It would look so dumb if it didn't work out. But I'm like, man, you cannot stop these guys. Like, maybe onside kick here, maybe, you know. But I
get, yeah,
4 minutes left. Know, it would look silly if that didn't work out.
You have everything says there. You have to play like you have a competent team. Like, you really do. And I in those situations, what I go down to is, like, if you really have to try the onside kick there when you're more than set up to, you can even withstand a first down given where it is.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you just, that's the way the game needs to be played, because you're going to end up pinning yourself in a really, like, it's so easy for you to make it worse over a pretty low percentage of it happening. Like, what's onside kick recovery? Is it 15%, 20%?
It's got to be way lower than that, right? I know it's like astronomically low in the NFL, but
yeah, it's 10% in the NFL now with their new stupid rules.
Oh, I didn't realize it was that high.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I didn't realize, but it is. It's 10%. Although, did you see the Seahawks? It was the worst.
They tried.
It was the worst onside kick recovery I have ever seen. Like, a dude tried to recover it with one hand behind his back. It was literally a one hand behind his back attempt. Now, granted, he got hit, but I'm digressing. I don't have any second guessing about them, the onside kick.
Like, no,
that's not the situation for it. I want to give. This is the other thing. I think I really like how DeBoer manages game situations. When he goes for it, how aggressive he is. Like, I don't want to. Everything's going so well in that regard that I don't want to mess with it over something that I would consider sort of kind of trivial or like nitpicky. Because I love like him going for it near the goal line when they went for it. I like how aggressive he is.
Yeah, and I don't second guess the decision at all. I guess it just speaks more to like the vibe of the game and how how like leaky they'd been defensively that when they scored I thought like I don't know that you're getting the ball back if you kick it deep here, but
you know what kind of idiot I am is that I was like, oh no, they figured something out, like the defense, like they finally unlocked the secret, like I was talking myself into that. They forced a punt, now they're going to force another one, and UCLA's out of rhythm.
Well, they did have fourth down stop too there, so
yeah.
Yeah,
that didn't work out great though, like, in the long term, did it?
Charbonnet had a good game, but if UCLA had felt like their only chance to move the ball was to run it every play like they did last year at Husky Stadium, I don't know that they were so effective running the ball that, like, you know, that would have been something they could ride to a victory. So yeah, maybe you get in a late game situation and you're more definitely. I think you're definitely more confident in this defense against the run than against the pass. I was thinking though, until they play Oregon, I mean, their next three games are at ASU, then they're home against Arizona, and then they're at Cal. And, like, of those three, Arizona's really the only one that, like, I think could really test them through the air, right? Like, Cal just scored nine points in Pullman.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm Cal and their defense gives UW such a hard time, and whether there's some sort of karmic debt of however did it go, like 25 years where Washington kept beating Cal, and now like past 10 years it's just been brutal playing them. Like, but you're right, moving it through the air, Washington shouldn't have to worry about the Bears air raid in this game.
They did once run the Bear Raid though, which was a great name.
Is that the what's the name of the dude?
It was when they had Sonny Dykes.
Yeah, it's the Bear Raid was that. That school, I don't think, is intended to have a good offense. Like, I think there are certain things. Like, I just don't think it was meant to be for Cal really to ever have a potent offense. I don't think it works that way. Gilby came pretty close when they had Russell White, but I just don't think it's in the cards for them.
Don't tell that to Aaron Rodgers.
That's true. Aaron Rodgers. Yeah.
Marshawn.
That period of time where they got the amount of talent that Cal had on those teams is wild. Absolutely bonkers how good they were under. That was Tedford, right? The Fighting Tedfords?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they were wildly good, but still weren't consistent. Something about the lack of discipline from the hippie heritage of that school.
I'm just glad they got the people out of the trees so they could renovate the stadium. I love Cal. I love that campus. I love going down there. I'm looking forward to that trip.
It's great.
Did you?
I will quote my father's letter to his mom when he was attending Cal, from which he graduated, and he said, "Berkeley's a great town. If you don't mind people you don't know asking you for $5 in a place that smells like dog crap,
you can do worse." Did it immediately jump out to you when Dorian Thompson-Robinson completed a 17-yard pass to his tight end? And Washington was flagged for defensive holding, and they committed a late hit penalty, dead ball foul. Did it immediately occur to you that was strange that the 17 yards and the defensive holding penalty were granted before, and then also the dead ball foul?
I knew that the defensive holding should not have been applied. Like, I knew that that was that that struck me as being a mistake, that you either get the penalty or you get the yards. You don't get both. I got confused about, I think because it was dead ball, it that should have been added to it, but I was less certain. I knew a mistake had been made.
So the dead ball penalty was correct. You always assess a dead ball foul, even if a live ball foul had been committed by the same team. And I was actually I went deep into the rule book on this one. So I'm going to, I spent my time doing this, and so now you have to hear my explanation. And it's in my story on The Athletic today, if you prefer to read, but here we are and you're listening to this already. So what the hell?
That's a terrible tease, Christian.
Yeah, that's what I do. I mean, you know that by now.
Well, I looked all of this up, so listen, you can read it if you want, but actually I'm just going to tell you about it. No, you go like this. Christian Capel saw something that was odd that many people commented on Twitter, and being of steadfast nature and curious disposition, he decided to look into it to come up with an explanation for all of you who've been wondering, what in the hell were those square-headed idiots in stripes? What were they doing on this play? Go ahead, Christian.
So, like Danny was saying, I'm a genius.
And, yes, exactly.
So
leather journalism, folks.
I interpreted the NCAA rule book. Great read, by the way, if you've never taken a look at it. The key here is the term running play. And what a running play is basically a ball carrier running with the football. It's not just a rushing play. It's any play from scrimmage that is not the portion of the play that's the legal forward pass. So it's either a quarterback running with the ball from scrimmage, a running back running with the ball from scrimmage, or a quarterback completing a legal forward pass to a receiver, and then that receiver running with the ball. A running play on a pass, so on a legal forward pass, a running play does not begin until the receiver has completed the catch, okay? So that's the key here. If you watch the replay, the defensive holding call against Fatu Tuitele clearly occurred while the ball was still in Dorian Thompson Robinson's hand, certainly before it was caught by the receiver. So in that instance, you enforce the penalty from the previous spot. Obviously, UCLA would have declined that because the play itself gained 17 yards.
Yeah.
So they should have had 17 yards, and then the personal foul penalty would have been the full 15 rather than half the distance to the goal. So they would have made 32 yards of progress on that play. As it was, they assigned, they enforced the defensive holding penalty as a tack on, and then that brought them close enough to the goal line that the personal foul was then half the distance. They wound up getting 39 yards out of it. Danny, you watched the game. I don't think anyone believes 7 yards would have made a huge difference for UCLA scoring a touchdown there.
But you're familiar with the butterfly effect, though, right?
You never know.
The butterfly effect, if a butterfly flapping its wings, I don't know, somewhere like Indonesia, might translate to a huge tropical storm somewhere across, because it starts a ripple of breeze that then starts a chain reaction of events. So perhaps those 7 yards were the difference. I got to go back, though. So if the holding penalty had occurred after the receiver caught the ball,
then it's a tack on. Then you do enforce it.
Are you serious?
And give them the play. Yes. Yeah. Which I don't know that I knew that.
I absolutely didn't know that. That makes no sense at all.
And that means any rushing attempt then that has a defensive holding call on it is a tack on. This happened last year, and I just remembered at the time, like, because I don't think I knew that at the time, so it kind of stuck out. Like, wait, they got the yardage too. Ryan Bowman committed a defensive holding penalty against Cal last year on an a Chase Garber's scramble, and they got the yardage and the penalty yardage. And I remember thinking, like, what is that right? But it just kind of forgot about it. This one, I think, was a little more noteworthy because it also had the dead ball foul tacked onto the end.
Yeah. There's a lot happening. Huh. I absolutely didn't know that. In the NFL, it's 5 yards and an automatic first down. So I guess that, because I can see the rationale of saying that you can't, like, there's a penalty for defensive holding, and it's not like an either or situation, because otherwise you would have guys committing defensive holding and saying the worst thing that happens here is we give up 5 yards. And if they don't catch us, like, hey, that that there would be less incentive. Like, there's less disincentive to do it. Whereas if you're saying, like, okay, it's added on, you're like, okay, you actually really shouldn't do that, because even if the play is successful, they don't end up waiving off the penalty. Like, you really don't want to do it, because you'll add to the run that they just got. But still, that's weird. I didn't know that.
I think where the confusion comes in is, like, defensive holding is almost always just a, like, a substitution penalty for pass interference.
Yeah.
Called against DBs. Yeah, and, like, those are legal forward pass plays where the pass hasn't been completed. So it is always going to be a previous spot foul in those instances. So, like, 99% of the time, fans know that defensive holding is a previous spot foul. So when it's called on a D lineman against an O lineman, which is so rare. I'll say this. I mean, the officials were, like, I don't know, half a second to a second and a half or so from having ruled that entire sequence correctly. If the pass had been caught, but then, like, why would you call defensive holding on an offensive lineman once a pass has been thrown and caught by a receiver? There's no advantage to be gained then, right?
Well, you're not sure. Like, Latuli Gassanoa might run it down from behind.
Yeah, that's true. And I think
he's got 25 yards behind it, but he's motoring.
There was some RPO action on that play.
Some RPO. Why is it always RPO act? Like, RPO action, has now become a fix to it. Like, blitzes are always dialed up. Like, when your defense is hemorrhaging rush yards, you're being gashed.
The quarterback position.
Yeah, quarterback position is one of them. Like, these little weird phrases that we get into. A pitcher, when he faces more than six batters in an inning, is laboring. Like, now we've got RPO action.
I love
a little
laboring.
RPO action. Like,
it conjures such a specific image. The guys, he's taking his cap off and wiping the sweat off his brow with the back of his hand and walking circles around the mound. And
Oh, he's laboring.
That guy's laboring.
Yeah. You retire five in a row and you're cruising.
A guard can really score the basketball.
Which is funny, because I'd like to see him score something else. I know. He really scores popcorn containers. Like, well, you can't score with anything else, sir. Like, if he's scoring, it has to be with the basketball. It's similar to the Mike Gundy, a mother of children.
This article. That's not true.
A mother of children. Oh, that I'll always laugh at that. The day I die, I'll still be laughing at him talking about a mother of children.
15 years it's been.
Has it really?
Yeah.
God, and that guy's still there. Still there. Hell, he might have the best team in Oklahoma this year. Did you see the Sooners get dragged?
Yeah, rough start for them.
That was great. I love watching old Big 8 teams. Specifically Oklahoma and Nebraska, because for so many years, like the entire months of September, October, and even really the first bit of November would just be perfunctory for those schools. Like, it would build up to a meeting between the two of them. When I see one of them lose to like one of the teams they usually beat up on, I just take no end of delight in it. Like, TCU, the Horned Frogs gave it to the Sooners. It was great.
Sonny Dykes. There you go. Taking the Bear Raid to the Sooners.
Do they call it the Horned Frog Raid now?
They should. Did you read the Sports Illustrated story about all the acrimony between SMU and Sonny Dykes?
Yes.
That was so, man, that booster got his feelings hurt, man.
Yes, he did. And there is something unique and special.
It's hard to take it seriously.
About the way all of those, and it happens in various places, like how when a school gets, it happened a little bit to Leach at Texas Tech, but that was basically, I think Leach was difficult for everybody there to deal with. But like the stuff with Houston Nutt at Arkansas was absolutely a riot, and that continued after he left. When you see a real live grudge happen like that, it's unique to college football, because usually in the pros the coach just goes away, and like the coaches have enough power in college football that sometimes you have like a legitimate like blood feud that starts.
I like the part where he said like his family was was going to wait to join him, but it got like, it was just so bitter and like so toxic there that they had to leave early. not what you want.
No. Well, you take a job at SMU, like honestly, like when you take a job at SMU, you know that's part of the score, right? Like there's something off about that institution. It can be 30 years, 40 years have passed since the whole death penalty thing, but like that school had a payroll. And if you've ever watched, like the 30 for 30 on it is pretty good. I think it's called Pony Express.
Like, Pony Excess, NCAA, I believe.
Oh, is it Pony Excess? That's a pretty good play on words. Yeah. Like the school gets told by the NCAA, like, you've got to stop paying these players. And all the boosters are like, okay, but we got to keep paying them for now because we've got contracts with all these guys and we can get sued if we don't keep paying them.
Which is like understandable.
Yeah, it is. That's cheating. Like, there's cheating, and then that's cheating. So if you take a job there, don't you know that that's kind of in that place's DNA? Like, you're like, something's off here. Like, it could, I know it's two generations removed, and they got their program shut down, but there's still something in here at the core of the people that love this school that is off. Like, these people are nuts when it comes down to it. And sure enough, like, so when you come after it, like, oh, my God, this booster's crazy. I'm kind of like, yeah, he is. But you kind of knew that going in, right? Like, this wasn't advertised, that there was no warning that things might go haywire at SMU.
And then he went from there to a school where he's replacing a coach who has a statue on campus.
Yeah. It can be tough. It can be tough. And now what Gary's coordinating... Is it Texas's defense?
Where is he now?
It's either Texas or Alabama.
I feel like he was there as an analyst.
No, I think he's calling a defense. I might be wrong about that.
He's special assistant to the head coach at Texas.
At Texas? Okay. Oh, he's not the coordinator. My bad. So he's like their Tedford?
I guess so.
Like when Tedford came to the University of Washington for a year and I chalked up all of Jake Browning's success to him.
Yeah, so are they going to like set every defensive record this year? I don't think that's happening, though.
No, it's not, but they did look better. Like, I shouldn't say that because I basically just watched the Alabama game when Sark was there looking like a 1990s R&B singer dressed all in white. I was worried, though, because his sunglasses were really tight. Like, it was like the side of his sunglasses were leaving like an indentation next to his head. Like, it was like, you got to get some sunglasses that fit, man. I was worried about like causing headaches, like looked uncomfortable.
My daughter has sunglasses we got her when she was, so she's almost, she'll be two in December. And we bought these probably when she was like 5 or 6 months old. So when we went on walks, the sun wouldn't be in her eyes. And so sometimes they're still like sitting around the house. She puts them on and they like just barely fit. They look like swimming goggles because they're so tight against her face. So she understands. She understands the struggle there.
That's what happens anytime Ryan Divish puts on sunglasses. No, that's not true. Because he's got big, massive sunglasses for his big, massive head.
I saw a graphic today scrolling through Twitter, and I think it kind of drove home maybe the perspective needed on this Washington team right now. It was just touting, you know, all the Pac-12 teams that are ranked, which there's five of them, USC, Utah, Oregon, UCLA, and Washington. And in, you know, Washington's on there. They're 21st. And mm-hmm. Here's this graphic. It's 5 weeks in, five games in. Here's all, you know, these are the kind of the cream of the Pac-12 right now. Washington number 21. And I thought, you know, if you went into a coma on September 2nd and woke up today and the first thing you wanted to know for some reason was how Washington's football season was going and you just saw that graphic, wouldn't most people have taken that at this juncture?
Yes. 100%. Like, I'll raise my hand and say, like, am I satisfied and encouraged by the first five games? Yeah, I am. And while the result was disappointing in at UCLA, I would have felt way worse if they would have gone down there and scored 13 points. Like, their offense is for real. Like, that offense has been legitimate and it's consistent and it was able turnover sunk them at the end of the first half. Like, if those two picks don't happen, like, they're not really... I don't know if they win that game, but it certainly changes the complexion. The reason that they weren't able to keep pace wasn't because UCLA started stopping them. It was because they committed a couple of turnovers. And credit to UCLA, like, they made the plays. But that offense is for real. Like, those are, like, that talent, the ability for Penix to coordinate and execute and be the trigger man, like, all of that's real. The defense, which I think there were a lot of real justifiable questions and that had not been definitively answered, we found out that, yeah, it does have some problems. And it's been able to mask those because it's gotten out to such big leads. But this defense is not going to... It's nothing to write home about when it comes to getting stops. Like, that is very much a work in progress. And the expectation that a coach win things are going very, very well, all things considered, 5 games into the Kalen DeBoer era.
I think it does kind of supply a bit of a data point for, like, okay, how adept is this coaching staff at, like, you know, immediately improving areas of deficiency on its team, on its roster. Cause like, if it's just a matter of not having the guys, which I kind of think it might be, mm-hmm. once they get healthy, maybe it's a little bit better that way. I don't know that there's a whole lot you can do in season. I think probably Kalen DeBoer is making some notes about, all right, let's hit the portal pretty hard at season's end and kind of get some more reinforcements in the back end. But, I am curious, like, schematically, game plan wise, are there things that they can do to kind of put those guys in better position? Because, like, one of the things we talked about with this defense before the season was, oh yeah, like, the safeties are going to be playing closer to the line of scrimmage. They're going to be more involved in the run game. I think you've seen that. They're probably going to play a lot more man coverage. I think you've seen that. They're going to trust cornerbacks in one-on-one situations. And those guys have been put in those situations. And on Friday, it wasn't pretty. So I wonder, like, is there room within this scheme and this structure to move guys around a little bit to maybe, okay, let's try to play maybe a little bit softer, or let's try to, you know, play a little bit more of like a, you know, keep guys in front of you type of defense the way you saw under Jimmy Lake. Because I just, like, the thing that was most glaring to me was not necessarily some of the coverage issues, just because, like, I think that was just going to be part of this team's DNA. They're not going to be as good in coverage, but the inability to make tackles one-on-one in space, because, like, they've been really good at that, good enough probably that, like, people came to take it for granted a little bit. It just seemed like, I mean, every time UCLA got the ball, you know, in the flat and there's a defender there, and if he makes the play, it's a 2-yard gain. It just seemed like it didn't get done, like the play didn't get made. And I think that's kind of what fans are like, that's what's most jarring, because people aren't used to seeing that from Washington's defense.
Yeah, I would say that I'm not sure if linebacker has taken the step forward that I thought it would or hoped it would. And I think that they're still working out some of the rotation there, exactly how they play. I'd like to see more Carson Bruner, but maybe they know something that I don't. But I would agree with the tackling. They're in a bit of a box because with Dom Hampton... Like, what is it's the Husky position? Is that what he plays that we call it? But it's essentially a nickelback, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's more of a thumper, right? Like, he's closer to a safety than it is to a corner, in my opinion. And they do pull the safeties up, and there's a little bit of daring teams to okay, go over the top. So they're inviting teams to do that, and I think when you face a quarterback that has a good game, and I think he had a good game. Like, I think he played well. And there's a little bit of, okay, that's the risk that you've taken. Like, you've opened that up and kind of said, this is who we are. And if you want to take these shots down the field, there are going to be those opportunities. I'm not sure how much they change from that template, though, because you go back and you don't want guys to start. If that's not what you do, if you're not a team that plays in a shell, and has two safeties that are back and keeps everything in front of them, I think it can be dangerous to try and sort of triage rather than just say, okay, we've got a high scoring offense, and that's the kind of game we're going to play. Is like, we're comfortable if it's going to be in the 30s.
I did like the over on Friday night, and it did not disappoint.
I will say, you know, I thought Julius Irving's looked pretty good.
Yeah, he said. I mean, he played great against Michigan State.
He did.
And you know, progress isn't linear, right? Always. Sometimes a guy can, you can look back at the end of the year and say that a defense got better from game one to game 12, but didn't look so great in, you know, looked worse in week five than it had in week four or whatever. And you know, there's a chance UCLA is just a pretty good team. They have a veteran quarterback who can hurt you with his legs, and really good running back, and some big receivers. You know, I think Washington would have liked to score more than 32 points against that defense. I do have a, I think, pretty good pass rush, and you know, obviously we talked about Leiatu a lot too, but it's not always the case that even really good teams are better in week two, better in week three, better in week four. It doesn't always go in a straight line like that. So I don't know that this game did anything to like change the way I perceive what this team is capable of big picture. Like, I mean, even after the Michigan State game, like I had a couple of people ask me like, oh, do you think this could be like a, you know, like a fringe, like a dark horse, like playoff team or something like that? And I'm like, nah, like they're not built to go undefeated. And they're not built to probably go 11-1. Like they just don't have, the depth of dudes defensively that they have in the past to make that happen. But like, I do think you look at the schedule from here, you know, Arizona State's dangerous. They showed that against USC. I was surprised at how long they hung in that game. You know, since they fired their coach, it kind of seemed like they might go in the tank mode. But, you know, they better take that trip seriously. They haven't won there since 2001. So, you know, none of these, like ASU, Arizona, Cal, obviously Oregon coming up, like that, none of those are gimmies. There's reasons to think that, like, all those teams could give them trouble. But in terms of what their biggest weakness is right now, which is pass defense and covering receivers, Jaden Delora, Jacob Cowing, and Tetora McMillan from Arizona, I think that's going to be like the toughest test just from a opposing team passing offense versus Washington's passing defense standpoint. I don't know if, you know, I don't know if your feelings toward Jed Fish will allow you to agree with that, but
they won.
They did. Again, they covered.
Yeah. They kicked Carl Durrell out.
Yeah, got Carl Durrell fired. He got the boot.
How about Paul Christ?
Yeah, I couldn't believe that.
They just axed him.
Did you see his someone tweeted his record?
It's pretty good.
His year-by-year record. I'll just read it off because it's like, Wisconsin fired that guy? Really? And he's like he's a classic, you know, Wisconsin guy.
Yes.
Cold world, man.
That's
so he went 10-3, 11-3, 13-1, 8-5, 10-4, 4-3 in the COVID year, 9-4 last year, and they're 2-3 this season. And they've pretty clearly regressed. Lost at home to Wazoo, not totally non-competitive against Ohio State, got smacked by Illinois and couldn't run the ball. But man, that is a quick trigger for a guy who's won at a really consistent level at a school that like doesn't typically, you know, do the quick trigger thing.
Yeah, they've had. I mean, Alvarez is I don't want to say finally out of there. Alvarez was there for so long, and he's no longer the AD. So there was part of me that wondered if this was a desire to sort of start fresh, because he had. Christ's roots dated back to he had worked at that school under Bielema because he was calling plays when Russell Wilson was the quarterback. So, but it was jarring to see. You've had some pretty good programs that now have, you have Nebraska, you have now Wisconsin, Colorado, which like would like to have, but Colorado might be the worst program in big boy football right now. Like it's
going to take a miracle pretty... for them to win a game this year. But with that said, like if Washington's,
do they not play Colorado State? Colorado State's terrible too.
No, they don't get them this year.
Oh, they don't. Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah. If Washington's 2008 season taught me anything, it's that like, I still, no matter how bad a team is, like that was that 0-12 year. It's such an outlier. Like you can watch a team start 0-5 usually and think, well, like look at the rest of their schedule. I don't see anybody that I think they're going to beat, but like, it's really, really hard to go 0-12.
Yes.
And like that's what makes that 2008 year like stand out so much to me. Like, wow, like look at all of these horrible, horrible, untalented football teams with, you know, terrible coaching, or they fired their coach mid-year or whatever, yet they all managed to win like one game or two games. And some of it was a non-conference schedule, I get that. But really, really, really hard to see how Colorado avoids becoming the conference's first 0-12 team since Washington.
Yeah, yeah. That's going to be no skin. I'll laugh if it happens because I enjoy misery. How did you feel like DeBoer like took the loss or reacted to the loss?
I think the way that you would want if you're a fan, like you don't understand how competitive he is until he starts talking about like things that didn't go the way he wanted them to go. And you can just like, that's when that edge kind of comes out. Not that he gets like, you know, grouchy or anything like that, but you really start to sense like, okay, like this is someone who has like a very high standard and very high expectations for, you know, for his program, and, you know, probably did not ever entertain the thought that like this was going to be a rebuilding year or whatever. And when they got off to that 4-0 start, they really did kind of act as if that was what they expected, and not like, you know, oh my gosh, look at this, you know, this maybe this year actually could be really good. Like, I think he's set a high standard for what he wants out of those guys on like a daily basis, practice wise and meeting wise. And, you know, they're like probably a bunch of other programs. They have the whole 1-0 mindset, go 1-0 in everything you do and blah, blah, blah. And like, that's easy for us to kind of roll our eyes at as a cliche, but, I do think like they've instilled that, and, you know, I think they expect to win. I think he got those guys like immediately thinking that they should be a team that wins every week. And so, you know, like you heard Ryan Grubb today talk about how, like, it was, you know, he was devastated about the loss, because they felt like they, you know, felt like they should have won, and they felt like they missed a bunch of opportunities. And, you know, Kalen DeBoer talked after the game about how, you know, that locker room was really hurting because they expect to win and all those sort of things. So, you know, he's, I don't think he's the type who's going to like dwell on it necessarily in a negative way. I think he very much, you know, is kind of the mind that it's only really a loss if you don't learn from it, and that you can't take value from it and those sort of things. And, you know, I think he ended his opening remarks Friday night by saying like, well, if you learned anything about this team today, it was that they're always going to fight. And like, he did emphasize the comeback and all that. So, I think
he didn't swear.
He did not swear. No, not at us.
Are we pretty certain that he's not a cursor?
That's what I've been told. I've been told he doesn't. I don't know. You know, maybe you could catch him slipping, but
no. Like, it's a foreign concept to me, but I have some admiration for a man who's able to set boundaries and stick to them. But we didn't get a glimpse, because, like, I always want to see, is it like, do we get a sort of psychotic level coach after a loss? Like, Jim Mora was kind of a psycho level coach after a loss.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to get that. I think he's pretty even keel, and, you know, he just doesn't lose a lot.
He's not used to it as
a head coach. I mean,
that's why it's an interesting data point.
Yeah. He had enough court, like, he was 10 years as an offensive coordinator at some schools that did not have a winning tradition. They like wasn't always part of teams that were, you know, pushing mm-hmm. double digit wins or anything. But as a head coach, like, yeah, he has not lost a whole lot of games in his life. So I'm sure it is like a very irritating feeling.
But he's also not like Tyrone Williams, because I always felt like Tyrone was in the process of like proving that he could be immune from any sort of emotional reaction to a result. That like, he would be the same boring, stiff human being after a victory as he was after a loss, that you were not going to be able to tell. Like, it was he was proving, like, winning some sort of $1 bet with the Dukes about whether or not it's like, I'm going to show you that I can take this once proud program and grind it into the 0-12 dust without ever once even raising my voice. Like, I can do it completely as emotionlessly as if I'm going through my morning rituals of getting ready. And he did. He seemed to be profoundly unaffected by suffering 12 straight defeats in that final season.
I think the best thing you can say about how DeBoer reacted was was that he was relatively more or less the same person that he is after victories, except just with a little bit more of an undercurrent of irritation, and not with any individual or anything like that. Just, you know, you could tell, like, this is Kalen DeBoer, and you can tell that this is Kalen DeBoer who just lost a football game.
I wouldn't want to dig into that. I want you to be observant in the future, Christian. I want to come up with an index of, like, when you know that Kalen DeBoer is upset, because it was one of my favorite things to do, of like when you can tell like the signs when Pete Carroll's actually upset, because he doesn't let it on usually, but there are a couple tells he has. So we need to come up with our list of, like, DeBoer is irritated indicators.
Is it what? So what is it with Carroll? Is it when he says, like, we got to be better at that?
Carroll is mad when he says we basically didn't get anything accomplished. Like, when he comes up, like, afterwards, like, he'll come up, and when they get there, and it hasn't happened that much recently, but it did happen early on when they just get their clocks cleaned. And he'll just come up like, we didn't get anything accomplished today. Like, at that point, you know, he is furious with sort of the way his team has played. And it's not even when he's mad at a media member. It will usually be like, he'll say something like, well, that's an interesting way to put that.
Yeah.
Like, there's some sort of like, interesting the way you phrased that. Like, there's a pause where he just wants you to let you know that, like, I realize you're putting a point on this question and trying to get a response out of me. I'm going to acknowledge that, and I'm going to proceed to give you sunshine right back. Like, that's all you're going to get is big happy. I know what you're trying to do, and here's more sunshine for you.
One of my favorite Carrollisms is when he gets asked, like, you know, how do you guys plan to handle, or like, how do you think you guys will handle, or how do you think you guys have handled, you know, this or that? And he'll just say, like, really, really well.
Yeah. It's one of the things,
probably,
because,
really,
like,
well.
If you take, like, interviewing classes, which I've taken, they'll tell you how questions are way better than yes, no questions.
Oh yeah.
Like, to say, like, are you, did you, like, you're better off, how did you? And Pete Carroll's found the counterpunch, because if you ask him a how question and he will disengage from the question, like, you'll see it. As soon as you say how, he'll look up at you and there'll be this little glint in his eye. And he's like, I got something for you on this one. And you know what's coming, because he's going to say, we'll handle it really well.
Yeah, really well.
We plan to do that really well.
I thought, man, really, really cool performance in the passing game today.
Yeah, they're really cool. You just couldn't ask for anything better.
Everything's really cool.
Yeah, it's
really, it's really great. Cool.
Yeah. So I collect some indicators of when we know DeBoer's mad. If he gets specifically worked up at a specific media member, somebody that he'll go after. Pete would, I don't think he ever really picked on any media members. He would like to take a couple jabs at me though, every now and again, which I deserved.
It's not quite the same thing, but someone was asking Ryan Grubb today at his press conference in positive terms, just about the, you know, how good Romo Dunze is, basically. That's the start that he's off to. And he kind of paused and was like, he's really good. I'm glad he's here. And it's like, yeah, sometimes there's just only one way to say something.
One of my favorite quotes that I've ever heard from any interview ever. There's a guy named Sean Palmer who was one of the, I guess he would be considered one of the first professional snowboarders. Like, he was an elite X Games athlete at a time when the X Games were just starting. And he's a completely irreverent, like, he's everything about, like, sort of skate culture. And he was at the X Games, and he entered a skiing competition. I think it was like ski cross where they race. And he wins it. Like, he hasn't skied in, I think at that point in time, he hadn't skied in a couple of years. And my friend Jamie, who was covering the X Games for ESPN.com, which is where I was working, asked him, he's like, Sean, you haven't skied. Like, how could you win this? And he looks at me and goes, I'm pretty good, I guess. To this day, like 25 years later, Jamie and I will exchange that. Like, where it's like, I'm pretty good, I guess.
That's amazing.
It's such a great, like, why don't more people say that? Like, what were you thinking when you attempted that last second shot? I was thinking, like, God damn, I'm good.
Yeah. Look, I'm our best player. I'm the guy who should be shooting this. And even if I miss, I was still the guy who should have been shooting that. So
yeah, and I'll tell you that I'm going to make it next time because I'm really good.
Yeah. That's math.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Maybe.
Well, this is another two episode week, I think, since we're here on a Monday.
We got to double up.
So we'll do our Pac-12 picks next time. I will say again, thank you to everybody who has rated and reviewed our podcast, especially on.
Nobody emailed me though.
They didn't.
Yeah, I was kind of bummed.
I'm gonna email you like 13 different variations then for
sure.
Yeah.
So email me if you missed it out. I'm now going to throw it in. I'll give you a dang apostrophe T-shirt if you email me a job description for what I currently do at danny@dannyoneal.com. It's very, very simple. There's no apostrophe in there. DANNY@dannyoneal.com that we can post, or you can post my job description with your review of our podcast, which really does help people find out about it.
I'm writing a mailbag this week, but for the first time, I'll say if you have a mailbag question you'd like answered on the podcast, you can tweet it to me or Danny, and we'll compile those and maybe answer a couple in our second episode later this week. I think we're at 42 five-star ratings on Spotify and 40,
really?
49 five-star ratings on Apple Podcasts. So
power to the people.
Every single one of those people. Yeah. Thank you for letting us know how you feel and for giving us some ratings. But we need more, you know, that's the point. To our 50th five-star rater on Apple Podcasts, we will give you another episode of this podcast. I don't know who, you know, there's no way for me to know who that person's going to be. So it's hard for me to, like, you know, promise anything monetary. I could, if you give it a five-star rating and shoot me a DM saying it was you, I'll send you the link before I tweet it out to everybody else. So you can have, you know, you can have a 10 second
sneak peek. I was going to say sneak peek, but it's not really a peek. It's a listen.
All right. We'll see you later this week. Enjoy your Monday, your Tuesday, and your Wednesday, and your Thursday. I know we're going to try to.
We will. And what I have to say about the show is it was pretty good, I guess.